We always have so many things to tell our audience about here at Intelligence Squared. So when I'm needing a top-down view of it all, I don't want to feel like I'm looking at organized chaos. That's why I really love Notion, which lays out different threads of work in a beautifully designed layout. And despite all of its clever AI tech going on in the background, it feels as clear and easy as putting pen to paper. Remember that? But with Notion, you can do a lot more than jot down a few thoughts. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. And thanks to its AI-powered model, the way it works is so intuitive, every question has an answer. I still love my paper notebook, but sitting next to Notion, it might need to up its game a little bit. Try Notion for free and up your game too when you go to notion.com/squared. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting Intelligence Squared too. That's notion.com/squared.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to this week's Intelligence Squared podcast. For this week's episode, we were joined by Jennifer Eberhardt, social psychologist at Stanford University and author of Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think and Do. In a wide-ranging interview with the BBC's Razia Iqbal, she explores the science behind the hidden prejudices that shape racial inequality around the world. We hope you enjoy the podcast, and if you're interested in coming to any Intelligence Squared events, do go on our website, intelligencesquared.com, and you can use an exclusive discount code. Just type in podcast at the checkout.
Hello, I'm Razia Iqbal. I'm a journalist for the BBC. Welcome to this week's Intelligence Squared podcast. You can sign up for regular updates about podcasts and other events at intelligencesquared.com. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Really good to be with you. Your book opens with a story that is so striking. I wonder if you would tell us. It's about your son when he was 5 years old, traveling on a plane with you.
That's right.
And he makes an observation.
Yes. So he looks around on the plane and he's all wide-eyed, right? He's all excited about being on that plane. And he sees this man and he says, "Hey, that guy looks like Daddy." So I look at the guy, and the guy looks nothing at all like my husband. So I'm looking like, what's going on with him, right? And so I start to look around on the plane, and I realize this guy's the only black guy on the plane. And so I'm thinking, all right, you know, I'm going to have a talk with my son about how not all black people look alike, right? So I'm getting all set up to have this talk. But before I could say anything, my son looks at me and says, "I hope he doesn't rob the plane." And I said, "What? What did you say?" And he said it again. He says, "Well, I hope he doesn't rob the plane." And I said, "Well, you know, Daddy wouldn't rob a plane." And he said, yeah, I know that." And I said, "Well, why would you say that?" And he looked at me with this really sad face and he says, "I don't know why I said that. I don't know why I was thinking that." And, you know, I use that story to open up, you know, the book because I want people to understand how, you know, bias is not about this unconscious bias. You know, it doesn't require evil people. It doesn't require bad actors. It just requires a person who's out there and absorbing things from the world. And this is what my, you know, son had absorbed.
At the age of five, he was already absorbing the association of black people with crime.
Yes.
And that must have really shocked you.
It did.
What were you thinking you might be able to do to counter that for him, apart from your own professional pursuit?
I think for me, I am a social scientist, and so that's my go-to, and I really believe that part of the countering is actually noticing that it's happening and being able to talk about it. So, you know, we had that conversation. I didn't just let it go and pretend like I didn't hear him say what he said. Even though I felt like that, I wanted to, you know, not believe, right, that he had said it. And I didn't want to have that conversation. But I confronted him with it. And I made him think. I asked him questions until he could tell me, you know, what was going on. And I did it in such a way that he would think about that again. He would think about that conversation when he had that kind of a thought again.
I thought it was very interesting because you go on to tell a story about yourself and how when you grew up in a largely African-American area, your parents then moved to an area that is more diverse, and you have to get to know white kids in school.
Yeah.
And the point of that story, again, is to show that it's possible to have bias,
right,
that isn't to do with being in a position of status or power. It is just an ordinary thing. Just tell me that story, because I think it's so fascinating that you are immediately inclusive in this book.
Well, yeah. So I was 12 years old when my parents decided to move us from a neighborhood that was all black to a neighborhood that was pretty much all white. And so I'm sort of nervous about going to the school and about being accepted and whether I would belong, whether I would fit in and so forth. And it turned out that the students at the school were great and they welcomed me and they showed me around, and I still had problems making friends. And that problem came from me, you know, from not being able to actually tell their faces apart. So they'd be nice to me and I wouldn't be able to tell one from the other the next day. And it was hard to keep track of who was who. And I was so motivated to do it, but I couldn't do it because I had not been exposed really to white faces in that way. And so it just took some time for me to, for my brain to kind of catch up to this new environment that I was in. And
I'm so intrigued that you choose those stories to open the book with, because it feels to me that you want to make it a comfortable space for people to talk about issues that are difficult.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that is my hope for the book, is that people can read it and that it could play some small role in encouraging people to think about these issues and have those conversations.
But this is all also rooted in the science and the experiments,
yes,
that you have conducted. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about those in a moment, because I want to just establish whether you are absolutely clear in your mind, given the stage that you're at professionally, that unconscious bias is really not the same thing as racism.
Right. That's right. I mean, so unconscious bias is something that we're all vulnerable to. And in the book, I'm looking at the science behind it, right? And people oftentimes will think, okay, if you're talking about bias, that means you're talking about people who are filled with hate. You're making a moral argument. You're saying I'm a bad person, all of these things. And, you know, so we're thinking about, as scientists, we would define unconscious bias as the beliefs and the feelings we have about social groups that can influence our decision making and our actions, even when we're not aware of it.
Okay, but there are still power relationships at work, because
yes,
a lot of the mapping that you do,
yeah,
it is something that I really want to get into. You genuinely believe that it's possible to neurologically map unconscious bias?
Yes.
Tell me about some of the experiments that you look at in the book, because one of the ones that really struck me was the one where a group of young men are consistently, African-American men, consistently,
right,
engaged in petty crime,
right,
against Asian women.
Right.
Just tell me that story.
Well, yeah. So they were going to Chinatown and they were robbing the purses of these middle-aged Chinese women. And when the police, you know, asked them, well, why are you going there? Why are you focused on them? And they would say, you know, because they can't tell brothers apart. basically. So they understood, you know, the science on one level, and they kind of used that to as cover. And so, you know, I say in the book that they could rob them in broad daylight and they needed no mask because their face was their mask.
And yet if they had targeted African-American women, those women would have been able to identify them.
Right. In an instant, right?
Let's look at the kinds of experiments that you've conducted that show that unconscious bias exists in so many different areas. Tell me about some of the ones that particularly interested you, kind of the facial recognition tests that you have conducted.
You know, with those tests, we were interested in looking at to see if there was some neural correlate or some neural basis for this, what researchers call the other race effect. And that's simply, well, you know, what we've been talking about, that people are better at recognizing faces of their own race than faces of other races. And so we conducted a neural imaging study where we put people in a scanner, black and white participants, and we showed them images, the faces of, you know, black people and white people, and we just looked at how the brain responded. Now, there's an area of the brain called the fusiform face area, and that area is sort of towards the back of the brain, and it gets activated. It's highly implicated in face processing, especially or sort of being able to determine the identity and faces and recognizing faces and so forth. And we found for both black and white subjects that that there was more activation in that area of the brain to faces of their own race than to faces of other races.
But then there's an extension of this particular type of mapping where the idea is to try and figure out whether people instinctively associate black faces with criminal intent.
Right.
What is it that you found when you conducted those experiments?
Well, we conducted a lot of those experiments over years, and you find that there's a really tight association between blackness and criminality. And it's so tight, in fact, that it can influence not only how we see people, but how we see objects and how we see places and, you know, how we see other things. And so it's pretty strong. So, for example, if you just expose people to a series of black male faces and you show them, you know, blurry images of objects, and some are crime relevant like guns and knives and others are crime irrelevant like staplers and cameras, we find that just exposing them to those black faces facilitates their ability to recognize these blurry images of guns and knives and so forth.
Just to extend the argument a little further, because you've done an awful lot of work with police departments,
yes.
Because you're clearly making a direct correlation between the bias that people instinctively have as a result of the society in which they move with the responses that they then have in a professional capacity. So, for example, across America, you know, for many, many years, we have seen the relationship between police departments and African-American men in particular, which has deteriorated over time.
Yes.
To the point where we have seen police officers shoot young African-American men, sometimes in the back.
Yes.
And so on. And it's given rise to the Black Lives Matter movement and a lot of societal pressure, which hasn't often resulted in justice being seen to be done. So I want to look a little bit at the experiments that you conduct that actually make a connection between how a police officer behaves when they stop someone who is white as opposed to when they stop someone who is African American.
So, for example, we've done studies where we've looked at body-worn camera footage from police officers. And here we were interested in looking across a large number of these cases. So we looked at 1,000 routine traffic stops. So it wasn't just one case or isolated, you know, situation. And it was the kind of, you know, interaction that's pretty routine. Everyday interactions. And we were interested in whether officers spoke to black drivers in a different way than white drivers, basically. That was the basic idea. And we found that, you know, officers were speaking you know, professionally overall, but there was a difference. They spoke in a less respectful way to black drivers than they did to white drivers.
I want to focus and highlight on your own personal experience. You were about to graduate from Harvard,
mm-hmm.
and you were stopped
yes.
by a police officer. You were with a friend in a car, and right. you were stopped. Tell right. us that story, because it was pretty unpleasant.
This was a while ago. Yeah, it was just, I mean, this was the day before my graduation from Harvard with a PhD in psychology. And I was just driving with a friend in Boston. We got pulled over near a housing complex, and the officer, we didn't know why we were pulled over, and he just didn't seem interested in clearing that up for us at all. And we were detained for quite some time, not knowing what was going on. The officer spoke really rudely to us, just really disrespectfully. And so
physically assaulted you too.
Yeah, in the end, because he showed up, you know, at the car door and demanded that we exit the car after we'd seen a tow truck come. And, you know, so and we didn't know what was going on. And so I just decided to sit in the car. And I felt like, you know, I didn't deserve that treatment. And I was sitting in the car basically in protest. And so sitting quietly in protest. So he decided to just open the car door and yank me out. And he body slammed me on the roof of the car. And it just knocked the wind out of me. I couldn't speak. And my body kind of went limp. And yeah, he arrested us, handcuffed us, and took us to the precinct and handcuffed us to a wall.
So at this point, I suppose I ought to let the listeners know that the police officer in question was black.
Yes.
So explain to me your interpretation of that event.
Well, I mean, at the time, I didn't know. I mean, I was just upset, you know, by what had happened at the time. And I felt like, in terms of its effect on me, that, you know, I felt less safe, I guess, in the world, that this could happen. And there were five cruisers that showed up for these expired tags. That was the offense. And there were all these people all around on the street watching, and just the idea that I was at the center of the storm and that so many people could watch this, witness this, and there was nothing that could be done. And the behavior was so brazen that he knew that, like, he could treat me whatever way, no matter what time of day, no matter who was watching. And so that upset me, for sure. But it wasn't until many years later, I guess in writing a book, really, that I recalled that incident again. And I could see it as a part of a larger issue, right? So it wasn't just, you know, this unfortunate thing that happened to me. It turned out that in the 90s, you know, when this was going on, you know, this was a practice that was, you know, that police departments around the country used to, you know, to stop people and to check them out and to, you know, especially people they were, you know, suspecting of criminal activity, they would sort of use this, these sort of pretextual stops where you get stopped for some minor violation and it gives the officer the right to pull you over and to talk to you and check you out and see what's happening and all of that. And it's perfectly legal. And so this was a major crime fighting tool for a long time. And it's to this day, I mean, I think that's why a lot of resentment has built up, over the years, against, police officers, especially when you're looking at, communities of color and African Americans in particular. So yes.
You are a natural storyteller in this book, and you pepper the entire academic research that you have done with personal stories like the one that you've just shared,
mm-hmm.
but also stories that are rooted in our own society's consciousness.
Yes.
You know, really powerful stories from the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles, which resulted in riots, to the more recent killings of African American men at the hands of American police officers. And I wonder, as an African American woman who has boys,
mm-hmm.
who are growing up in America, I wonder how you reflect, as you have in the book, about mm-hmm. that, their story, their lives, against this big backdrop that you have such an acute understanding of.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard, but it's also easier because I'm a social scientist, and so the questions that I have about that are, you know, questions that I could explore through research, and I can, you know, seek answers and provide those answers, right, to the world and to, you know, people who are sort of interested in these issues. And I feel like, you know, there's a unique vantage point that, that comes, you know, from that. And it's a way, you know, it's funny. I didn't learn this until writing the book either, just the role that science can play in all of our lives. I think, you know, for me, for a long time, science was about information and knowledge seeking and so forth. But I realized just how many people I met in the course of writing the book, and that I, you know, talked to, who shared their stories with me. And I came to realize that they, that the science actually soothes, you know, that, that, you know, there's a way in which they welcome, you know, the science that helped them to understand, you know, what's going on and what's happening to them. And I remember meeting with Tiffany Crutcher. And so she's the twin sister of Terrence Crutcher, who was shot by the police when his car broke down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he had his hands up in the air and he's walking towards his car. And he was, you know, he was shot and he died. And so
she was his twin.
She was his twin. And she said to me that she felt like she, a part of her died, you know, with him. And, you know, so she's left on her own trying to figure out, well, what happened and what can I do and how do I move forward? And so she's been sort of involved in, you know, police reform efforts and so forth. But I don't know if the science for her really mattered. I mean, it really.
She's a doctor, right?
Yes, yes, that's right. She told me, she called me after the book was released and said she had read the, you know, the chapter that I had written about, you know, the family to her parents. And she said the three of them just cried, and there were tears of, I don't know how to explain it. I guess, tears that represented hope for change. Like there was something, in having that information and having the science that, you know, allowed, some comfort, you know, for them. And so, and I kind of feel like that too. And just in my own life, like, and you ask about, you know, my children and how do you, you know, handle all of this. And I guess the science soothes me too. I mean, that I go to it because it does feel like it gets me through.
One of the most moving parts of your book is when, in the context of the soothing powers of science. Not a sentence I've ever thought I would say out loud, frankly, as a completely illiterate science person. But it's that period of time when you are teaching prisoners, some of them who are facing not just life, but I don't know if there's anyone who's facing the death sentence.
Well, no, but just, there were a lot of lifers.
There were a lot of lifers in San Quentin prison.
That's right.
And just tell me the impact, because your relationship with those people was so fascinating, not just because a lot of them were not very well educated and they were writing essays and papers for you, but also the impact of what you taught them about the social science of their fate.
That's a great connection. I hadn't even thought about that before, but yeah, you're right. The science meant a lot to them as well. And it's funny because I had wanted to teach at a prison for, you know, a while because I was doing a lot of work on the criminal justice system. But, you know, I felt like I kind of had a sense of you know, this sort of policing culture and the industry. And I knew somewhat a little bit, you know, about the court system, but nothing at all about prisons. You know, they're so, you know, they're behind these walls and you don't, you know, you know, who these people are and how, you know, it impacts them and so forth. And so, but then I thought, well, you know, I can go in and I could teach about stereotyping and prejudice and I can teach about race and crime, but I thought that would be depressing and that would just, you know, make things worse. And so for years I was thinking, well, I do want to go and teach, but I don't know if this is the thing I should do. And finally I went and I taught about those issues. And I have to say they were so grateful. You know, every time I came in, they were thankful. Every time I went in, we had these incredible you know, conversations, you know, about the criminal justice system, about their lives, about the way that race could influence, you know, people's decision making and these actors within the system. And so I learned so much from them. And then the first class I taught, the last day of class, they all, you know, clapped and they all thanked me one by one. And they told me that they were going to save these readings and that instead of it being depressing, it was completely empowering. I mean, there was a way in which they could see their own lives differently. I mean, in the same way, when I thought back on that arrest and all of that, I could kind of see the larger forces at work. That's how they felt. They felt like, you know, they weren't just, you know, in a particular prison in California and having their own experience. They could see, you know, how this was all taking shape, this mass incarceration across the whole country, and that they were a part of that. They could locate themselves within, you know, that whole, you know, movement that has happened over decades in our country, and come to it with a better understanding of the country and who they are and the system. And they felt so empowered, and I felt happy, you know, that I had gone there and that I had, you know, taken the risk of having those conversations with them.
We're just going to pause for a break.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Jennifer, let's talk about the presence of and the importance of leadership in the United States. Over the period of time that you've been working as a social scientist, America has undergone all kinds of changes, not least an African-American president.
Right.
The positive impact of that is quite clear to many people. But there are people, political analysts, who would argue that Barack Obama's very presence has resulted in the election of Donald Trump. I wonder how you reflect on what that meant to you, his election, how that might have changed society, what it did, particularly in the context of your work. You know, when Trayvon Martin, the young man who was murdered, when Barack Obama said quite clearly he could have been my son.
Right.
And yet even under his presidency, not that much changed in the context of the lives of African-American men. The Black Lives Matter movement rose during the time of President Obama. And I think those contrasts are interesting because it does tell us something about the forces in society.
It does, and it tells us something about the forces within ourselves. You know, we all have multiple selves. We all have, you know, as Du Bois would say it, right, these warring selves in one body. And that's real. And I think we're seeing that in, you know, the United States right now at this societal level, where you have, you know, two sort of forces going in opposite directions, being pitted, at the other. And where is this going to end up?
It's interesting you mentioned W.E.B. Du Bois, because, you know, his legacy, his intellectual presence is in your book, as is James Baldwin.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear you talk about the impact of these people on you as an intellectual, as a public intellectual, because there is a continuum, it seems to me.
Well, yeah, you know, I really started reading their work when I was in graduate school, and that work, those words, were comforting to me in lonely times. And I always wanted to you know, sort of take this new method of, you know, the scientific method, and, you know, use, you know, these sort of systematic studies to study, you know, some of the, you know, ideas that they contributed, you know, to our society. And so they were always close to me. And in fact, I open up the book with a quote from James Baldwin, and, you know, he says, "A journey is called that because you cannot know what you will do with what you find, or what you find will do to you." And I felt that in writing the book, that this was a journey, you know, for me, and I didn't know, you know, how it would change me. And I...
How do you think it has changed you?
I think it's changed me quite a bit. I mean, I think it's really recommitted me to the idea of having some social responsibility as a scientist. Not all of us feel that responsibility, right? I mean, all of us feel responsibility to our work, but in terms of our contribution to society, I mean, I think that sometimes gets lost. I mean, we want to have a contribution to science, right, and to our own discipline, but to really contribute to society, I mean, it's a whole nother level of responsibility. And I felt like I couldn't meet that responsibility and continue to only write articles in scientific journals that only other scientists would read. And so I wanted to write a book to, you know, share the work of social psychologists and other social scientists with the world.
And how do you interpret all of that responsibility, in the context of what you just referred to, this kind of polarizing society that we now see in the United States, but not only in the United States, in many other countries?
That's right.
In the context of your work, when we see the rise of white supremacists and some level of endorsement or complicity, depending on your perspective, by the president of the United States, and I'm thinking specifically of Charlottesville and what happened with the march there, I wonder how you reflect on that in the context of the social responsibility of your work that you speak of.
Well, yeah. So there's a lot of actually work on this issue of when bias is most likely to get triggered, and when are we most likely to act on it, right? Because, you know, even though we have, you know, a vulnerability to bias, we're not acting on it all the time. There are certain conditions that really bring it alive. And one of those conditions would be when the social norms shift. So, you know, we had this really strong norm in American society for a long time of being egalitarian. That's the value that we had. That's what we were striving for. But now you can see, you know, this eroding of that and the warring selves, right? That's coming about just from kind of struggling, some people trying to hold on to that, and some people trying to pull that back. And I think once that starts to erode, it affects all of us, and even people who really you know, it's important to them to be egalitarian. That's a huge value for them. When the social norms change, even their behavior starts to shift in that direction. We're social creatures. We're social beings. And so we're going to be responding to, you know, the environment that we're exposed to, even when, you know, we're not, even when we're motivated not to.
Do you worry, though, that there is, in the context of the specific work that you do, if you put that in the context of what we're just talking about, the warring sides, if you like, mm-hmm. lots of people on the other side from you, if you like,
yes.
would argue that the whole issue of unconscious bias, the mapping of it, is an industry now. It's an industry that some argue is social engineering with an agenda. I wonder what you would say to those, you know, academics who say that too, that there are people who argue that this, it's not possible to map in the way that you do people's responses. Actually, people's responses are to do with fear of having their job taken away from them, mm-hmm. or a whole number of kind of, you know, quite prosaic economic sometimes factors, as opposed to the visceral mapping of a brain that you're talking about. I wonder what you would say to those people.
Well, I mean, the economic insecurity and sort of fears about losing one's place in the world, that's real, and that can influence bias. So, you know, economic instability can trigger bias, fear and threat and stress and all of that, right? Can trigger bias. So it's not a pitting, this against that. It's understanding how there are multiple routes into bias, right? There are many sort of triggers of it. And the more mindful we are of those triggers, the more power that we have over it.
One of the things that struck me really quite strongly in your book was how you responded to the historical research that you were doing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there were moments when you actively wrote about how difficult it was for you to read the way in which people wrote about historians.
Yes.
Respected academics and scientists wrote about Africans, African Americans, Black people generally, right. and their intellectual ability or not, the smallness of their brains and so on.
Right.
The whole kind of movement of eugenics. And
right.
I was so struck by your willingness to speak openly and honestly about how much that upset you.
Yeah, I mean, it did. that's the only line of research that I engaged in where I had to put it down. You know, and I haven't done that work in a while because it was, you know, it was kind of starting to, affect me too much. And I used to love to talk about, you know, my research. But when I was doing that work, you know, I didn't like to talk about it. I didn't like people to ask me about it. And it was one of those things that would really, you know, throw a cold chill on the conversation, right? When you're talking at dinner and you say, hey, what are you up to? And I'm like, I'm looking at how people are still, you know, associating people of African descent with apes and what that says about us and what kind of impact that has on us.
And when you say you put it down, what kind of impact did it have on you emotionally? You had to just walk away from
it? Yeah, I walked away from it. I mean, I did work and I published that work and we did lots of studies and so forth. But at some point, I just felt like it was enough. And I mean, it may be something that I pick up again later. I didn't have enough distance from it, I think.
It's the kind of thing that one could imagine would make a person angry. And you don't strike me as an angry person. You strike me from your book as a deeply optimistic person and a very rational person.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether there is anger in you. Because, you know, when you talk about people like Baldwin, you know, Baldwin was rational, but he was mad as hell.
Yeah.
You know, he was angry about... Yeah. The disparity of the inequality of the inequality of respect, the
yes.
lack of respect.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I wonder how you channel the depth of emotion that you mm-hmm. clearly have felt in some of the research that you've done and how you live with it, how it sits with you now.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, the San Quentin students asked me that same question. I wanted to, this was in the first class I taught, like one of the last one of the last sessions we had together. I decided I was going to present my own work, and so I talked about the work on the, you know, Black Crime Association and all that, and then I talked about the work on this Black Ape Association, which actually was stronger, you know, than this Black Crime Association, even though at the time when I started the work, this was before Barack Obama's rise, right? And so people didn't discuss any of this, and students didn't profess any knowledge of this association or history or anything. And so I was, you know, I was doing that work, and I was marching on and working with a number of students on this and many studies. And I just will never forget. I presented that work, and again, all the men stood in line to shake my hand and thank me, and they thanked me and they thanked me, and then got to the last man, and he said to me, you know, he said, you know, I thank you for your work, and I really appreciate that you do this work. But he just shook his head and he says, I don't know how you do it. And he said, that is a heavy load. And I realized,
I think he said a heavy load of shit.
Yeah, he did say that. I didn't know if you could say that on your podcast. He did say that. And so that got my attention. And this was a guy, I think he was a lifer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I
and
that.
I thought, ooh, so that did make me pause. And I thought, you know, and then I had to realize, you know, at that point, I was thinking, you know, I think I'm at the end of my line on this one.
But ultimately it is the science that soothes you.
It is. It is. Yeah. And it's funny because I noticed that with other people, right? And then it was not until finishing the book that I actually noticed that really for myself, like I am a meaning seeker, and this is how I make it through the day and make it through life. And it's just to be in the position to explore these questions that we all have and have the skills to actually create this knowledge so that and give this knowledge to people so that they can understand more about themselves and their situation. I mean, I just feel like it's such a privileged position to be in. And I want to use that work to help to make, you know, the world a better place, really.
And a privilege to receive it as a reader. Jennifer Eberhard, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us.
Thank you.